From Chicago Public Radio, I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and this is Odyssey. Thelma Ritter, Frank Pangborn, Ward Bond. Recognize any of these names? Well, they're all character actors from the heyday of the Hollywood studio system. Character actors may not be well known by name, but their faces and performances are sometimes the most memorable thing in a movie. Coming up on Odyssey's Film Forum, the character actor in the movies. That's Odyssey, right after this. Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. We've all watched it happen. We go to a movie expecting that the star will be the center of attention, and then some riveting or menacing or hilarious supporting player steals the scene and ends up being the best thing in the film. Jude Law in last year's AI, Artificial Intelligence, by far the best thing in the film. Rupert Everett or Joan Cusack in just about anything they ever do. Supporting players or character actors aren't supposed to outshine the star, but just what are they supposed to do, and who decides that? Today on Odyssey's Film Forum, we're going to take a look at the character actor and the many things that he or she might contribute to a film. Joining us for the conversation is film studies scholar Allison McCracken. She's joining us from Berkeley, California today. Here in Chicago is film critic Hank Sarton and film scholar Pamela Robertson-Wojcik. Pam, let me ask you to begin with this term character actor. It seems to have a kind of slippery meaning. Let's try to pin it down. What does it mean?
Okay. Like all the terms you want to talk about, it's pretty complicated in terms of its history. Initially, the idea of a character actor can be thought of in terms of performance style. In a kind of 19th century realist mode, Stanislavski wanted everyone to be a character actor. And the idea was that instead of playing types, who were sort of simple, static, stock characters, actors should be trying to play characters with psychological depth, who changed and grew and had some complexity, and this went along with movements in terms of writing. In terms of labor, though, there's a different opposition that's between basically leads and supporting players. And this goes back to a different tradition in theater, which is the lines of business tradition, where an actor would basically belong to a repertory theater, have a certain category of role that they would play. So one actor would be the lead comedian. Another actor would be one of a number of supporting roles, like a heavy, a chambermaid, an ethnic type, and the ethnic types were pretty strictly organized so that someone might play the Yankee figure, they might play, you know, the Italian, they might play, you know, a certain particular character. There was one called Mose the Fire Boy, who was some kind of fireman in New York. So different levels of specialty. And
I would say that's a high level of specialty.
Yes. And you get this lines of business tradition carries over into Hollywood, where you have, in terms of performance, there's an assumption that both stars and character actors are working in a realist tradition.
From the beginning? From the beginning?
Yeah, more or less. More or less. We can talk about that. But both end up functioning as types in a certain way, so it sort of collapses that Stanislavski distinction. But in terms of labor and sort of institutional practice, casting still operates on this lines of business tradition. So the earliest casting directories in the teens, for instance, will categorize men, you know, there'll be books listing all the actors, and there'll be leads, juveniles, second leads, heavies, and what they call character men. And then this sort of operates through the 20s until contemporary casting directories, which still use these characters. They have leads, younger leads or ingenues, and then they lump together characters and comedians. And what character means in a lot of these casting directories tend to be actors who play ethnic roles, roles in heavy makeup, roles in uniform, or other elaborate costumes. And
so these are contemporary now casting directories that exist now?
Well, now it's more broad, and we can talk about what we think character means now. I mean, it tends to mean
actually,
not lead.
Okay, let's look at some of these distinctions, though. I want to focus for a minute on the performance distinction. Hank Sarton, can you jump in here? Because there is a way in which I think we understand that something different goes on in a performance from a lead and from a supporting player. Even if it may not always be the same distinction, but there's something to that.
Absolutely. And just picking up on some of the kind of history that Pam has been drawing out, this idea of character actors, strangely enough, it sort of gets inverted, that they become sort of, in some cases, types. So you get kind of the scruffy old sidekick in Westerns, and you know, that's Walter Brennan made a career of scruffy old sidekicks, and so he becomes a kind of character actor, and part of what we expect is that the performances, it seems to me, in a lot of cases in older films, we assume they're going to be broader, right? Bigger gestures, they're more often we've got these kind of marked change from the normal, like if we imagine Hollywood as sort of imagining a normal person, then the character roles are somebody who, there's something that makes them not like the lead. They're older, they're ethnic, they're comically weird in some way. You know, Edward Everett Horton, all these people who sort of made mannerisms into a career.
Who's Edward Everett Horton?
Edward Everett Horton was in a lot of the Astaire and Rogers musicals, and later went on to be an announcer for Jay Ward on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Fractured Fairy Tales
is Edward Everett Horton. Sort of did a kind of fussy comic man type.
Mm-hmm. Almost a pansy.
Almost a pansy. What you seem to get now is this expectation, I think, that when we talk about character actors, we just mean somebody who is not playing in the kind of big Hollywood easy tradition. They're more like, almost we think of them as more like stage actors, like they disappear into these interesting roles, right?
It seems like, Allison McCracken, maybe you can comment on this, but it seems like in some ways now the character actor, one of the functions they serve in a film will be to sort of lend prestige to the film. You know, you get usually some British actor to come in and play some wise role or something a little more sophisticated, let's say, than whatever's going on in the lead. And then everyone goes, oh, marvelous, and feels really good about themselves for being in the movie.
Yes, I mean, they're usually considered to add some kind of critical weight, often, to mainstream Hollywood film, and a lot of times you'll get these people who will play leads in independent films, but they'll be supporting actors that will give some kind of actorly weight or a critical weight to mainstream Hollywood film. Something like you think of, you know, Lily Taylor or John Turturro, people like that who are very much stars of independent movies, but when they're in mainstream Hollywood movies, often add this kind of actually white. Do you think of Lily Taylor doing the villain in Ransom, for example, and the idea that she's cast in that to give it some kind of more prestige and authority because here she's got this great resume. They've got Jennifer Jason Leigh being in Road to Perdition is a good example where she has this, you know, a lot of this great acting persona and a lot of critical attention, and yet they put her in this extremely small role in Road to Perdition. I think there was a Salon article just recently commenting on this, that she's barely in the movie, and yet she's supposed to give it, you know, this kind of weight and authority of that kind of character actor strength.
Well, that's interesting because for someone like Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's fairly young, or Lily Taylor, who's fairly young.
Not anymore.
Okay. Well, where does their prestige come from? I mean, we have this idea that when it's, you know, Sir So-and-so or Dame whoever, that they've had this long, illustrious career on the British stage that we know nothing about, and so they're lending some prestige to an American film. But when it's somebody much younger, whose career is entirely in film, where does the prestige come from, do you think?
It really comes from, in part, they're building up a critical mass, a critical reputation, primarily through doing independent films, particularly if we look at in the 90s, the way the early 90s, the way the independent cinema became this kind of alternative to Hollywood, which had, I mean, before we can think of in the 70s, the idea that, you know, you had these great reviews for actually Hollywood mainstream movies, but there was this split, right, in the late 80s, early 90s, where you get the rise of Sundance and the rise of independent cinema, and that was the sense that, oh, this is where the real acting is going on, where Hollywood is about event movies and Hollywood is about, you know, visuals and archetypes, and yet we have these character actors in independent cinemas, and that's where all the, you know, the really interesting critical work is going on. And so I think that they're building their reputations through these films, and then when they cross over into a Hollywood film, it lends this critical authority and weight to the Hollywood film that wouldn't ordinarily have.
We're talking today about character actors in the movies. Pam Wojcik, this, what Alison McCracken is describing seems like almost like the inverse of the early days, where somebody who came on and played a supporting role, you wouldn't even remember their name. You might never know their name, but you'd see them all the time. They didn't necessarily give the film a sort of critical prestige, or is that wrong? Do I have my history bad?
No, I think you're right. I mean, the earlier sense of a character actor would be someone who was on contract to a particular studio, who was part of a stable of players, who would show up in the film, not be the lead, be a regular workday actor. Only, you know, a particular kind of film buff would know their name. But you would recognize them. You would go, oh, that guy. I like that guy, or he's funny. And, you know, the distinction at that time between a star and a character actor might be that, you know, the star would be a type who would function across a series of films. Recognizable as a personality, but linked to some perception we would have of what we think we know about the real person.
So part of what we project onto them includes information we gather about their life outside of the movies.
Right. Whereas the character actor we might recognize as a type who has a particular shtick, as Hank was saying, a particular look, a kind of face, you know, a kind of role that they play that, you know, works across a series of films, but we don't know anything about them. We don't know their name. We don't have any imagination about what they might be like really off screen. As it turns out, you know, later on we learn about a lot of these people, you know, and they might be interesting. But in terms of their status for viewers, that lack of a real person, a perception of a real person, I think distinguishes them. And, you know, again, like theater, the stars might be loaned out to different studios, move from studio to studio to make films. Oh, we're going to borrow Cary Grant for this picture. Whereas the character actors are pretty much in-house. Certain character actors work for Paramount. They might, within that, then also specialize in Preston Sturges films.
Okay, work with a particular director, become a sort of even smaller ensemble.
Yeah,
it's interesting you mentioned Preston Sturges, because I was just thinking, as you were describing this, of someone like William Demarest, who is in Preston Sturges films. Let's see, we would know him best as the Uncle Charlie on My Three Sons, if you don't immediately conjure a picture of him. But, you know, did a career of kind of grumpy guys, and was, you know, predictably appeared in a series of films. And you do get these people who, and I think there's a kind of other interesting component to this, which is this idea of stables of performers who work predictably with certain directors as kind of the background. And obviously partly that's just because the director's working at a studio and they've got contract players available to them. But somebody like Sturges cultivates certain actors, and they become familiar, and they also get to explore a kind of range of what they can do comically within the type that they are.
Is the, we have to take a break in a minute, but and we'll come back and talk about this more, but is the transformation from one system or regime to what we have now all part of the story of the breakdown of the studio system and the sort of larger changes that are going on in the industry?
I think you want to think about larger changes in the industry, also just changing tastes in terms of looks, which break down our sense of what a star looks like versus a character actor, and also TV, because this is where a lot of character actors end up and shift through TV into something more like celebrity.
We're going to come back and talk more about that, in particular look at the relationship between character actors and leads and how what's going on in those performances connect up, but that's going to happen after a break. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
Later today on This American Life, what are you looking at?
Yeah, I would tell people, I'm like, what are you looking at? Do you have a problem? What, do I look like somebody or am I somebody?
It's a live show taped with people looking at us, a town hall in New York City, featuring Sarah Vowell, Dan Savage, David Rakoff, They Might Be Giants, and the This American Life Orchestra. It's later today on This American Life on Public Radio International. That's tonight at 7, tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Chicago Public Radio.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Kwadi Donovan Entertainment, presenting the long-running comedy Late Night Catechism, now in its 10th year, playing weekends at the Royal George Theater. Ticket information is at 312-988-9000 or through Ticketmaster. You're listening to Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, or on our website at WBEZ.org, where you can listen to our live broadcasts anywhere in the world. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. It's Film Forum here on the program, and we're talking about character actors. We spent a lot of time on this program talking about movie stars. Now we finally get to dig in past the stars, look at some of the other folks in the movie. Joining us for the conversation here in Chicago is Pamela Robertson-Wojcik, who teaches in the Department of Film, Television, and Theater at Notre Dame University. She is at work currently on a book about typecasting. Also in Chicago is Hank Sarton. He writes film criticism for the Chicago Free Press and the Chicago Reader, and he's a lecturer in the humanities at the University of Chicago. From Berkeley, California, we're joined by Allison McCracken, who has written extensively about supporting and character actors in film, television, and radio. This fall, she'll be teaching in the program in American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Let's turn our attention to the relationship between character actors and stars. Pam, you mentioned that, you know, a star we think of as being this type moves from film to film, and we have ideas about them that we bring to the movie and about their real life and all those sorts of things. Is that unrelated to what sorts of characters they might have around them?
No. Good answer. I mean, the interesting thing about the character actors is if you think about the sort of conventional Hollywood lead, and again, we'll talk about how that's shifted over time, but the conventional Hollywood lead, heterosexual, white, some kind of normative ideal of what we think we want to be.
Let's just say it, good looking.
Good looking.
Okay.
Definitely good looking. Whereas character actors are typically less conventional looking. There's actually great stuff in early casting directories and early actors' manuals that advises actors, you know, your face is your fortune, but not in the way you think it is. You might not be a lead, but there's lots and lots of space for goofy-looking people or, you know, masculine-looking women or things. And they recommend all these kinds of roles you might take, like prison matron or, you know, pansy or, you know, gunsel, all these different kinds of things.
What's a gunsel?
A gunsel is kind of a girlfriend of a criminal.
Oh, okay, like a moll.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's ways in which the supporting cast, I mean, literally do support the lead, and also, I think, contain a lot of excess that the lead can't, so that, you know, the support is where you get ethnicity being marked. It's where you get excess sexuality or different kinds of sexuality. It's where you get age. Hank mentioned earlier Edward Everett Horton. And the Astaire Rogers films are very interesting because the supporting cast in those films helps make Fred Astaire look like a conventional lead. Because without them, he looks old and weird and creepy. And he doesn't have a good body and all this. But you put Edward Everett Horton and Eric Blore around him, and they're these incredibly queeny men. Horton is much older than him, and this brings along, you know, usually some older female character, and suddenly Fred, the idea that Fred could be with Ginger seems plausible, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because in this universe.
Just to clarify, you've been using the word pansy. Pansy was a type, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was
an
actual type.
Yeah, and actually I have...
It's not just your judgment.
No. It's not a critique. And there are there's files of casting directors from the studio era that will have actors on file under the label pansy or Nance. As well as things like rube, mm-hmm. matron, you know, mm-hmm. these different things. So it was sort of a working term.
So this is really interesting to me. So in some sense, the characters around the lead tell you what the lead, what the lead is not. So in other words, if you have the pansy or the whatever, you know, the older person, the less attractive person, the bad person, those are all qualities that we understand then not to be in the lead.
Yeah, I think one of the things that does is it makes the work easier of putting together the lead performance and making that lead performance so that we can identify with that person. Now, of course, for some of us, we're much more likely to identify with, you know, Edward Everett Horton than Fred Astaire. Well, I don't know. Fred always seemed a little fey to me, too, but there you go.
And that's the point of having all those gay people around him.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, we're going to get letters.
Oh, boy.
Sorry.
I'll identify with either one of them. They're both great. But, yeah, I think there's a real sense in which there's that kind of, you know, these people are unusual, novel. We can sort of note their novelty and their strangeness. But that also, I think, becomes a kind of hidden pleasure of a lot of this, is watching these movies and you know, saying, look, there, even if you don't know her name, saying, ooh, there's Eve Arden playing the wisecracking girl sidekick again, you know? That sense that there's these people you recognize, and there's a little jolt of pleasure out of that.
Well, there's also the sense that it's not just that Eve Arden is what the female lead isn't, but there's something interesting about the fact that the female lead chooses to have Eve Arden in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of tells us that maybe she is something other than that normative ideal, because she's hanging out with this quasi-lesbian figure, the sort of masculine woman, Eve Arden. And so it complicates it in that way also.
Allison McCracken, can you talk a little bit about what television does to this whole structure or taxonomy of roles?
Well, it's very interesting, because if we see Hollywood film as being sort of a standard and setting a standard for kind of, you know, the most normative stars, we really have to look at other kinds of media as sort of allowing character actors to become stars in their own right. And we really see that happening with radio during the studio era in the 30s and 40s, where you have people like Eve Arden and Lucille Ball, who at that time was a character actor, and Peter Lorre, becoming stars of their own radio programs. And actually, you know, being the central character, the identificatory figure in those shows. And you see the same thing happening with television, when television really took over from radio, that particular role. So you get people who normally would be character actors. I think a great example was someone like Anthony Edwards, who comes from doing a number of supporting roles where he's sort of playing the dork or the intellectual or the geeky guy, and then is, you know, becomes the star of ER, and takes those qualities and sort of uses them in a particular way. Someone else like Edie Falco, for example, another great example of someone who does really smaller parts in independent films and then starts doing television and becomes a television star, and then has to make that transition between, you know, as Pamela was saying earlier, the idea that when a character actor becomes this kind of lead or star, their persona has to change publicly in interesting ways. And with Edie, the interesting thing that happened was she got a publicist, and she got someone who gave her a complete makeover after she won her first Emmy for The Sopranos, because they said she wasn't attractive enough.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The makeover seems to be the very first thing that happens to all of these people when they stop being character performers. It becomes like their teeth get whiter somehow, magically.
They do that a lot now. But it's very interesting that you get, I mean, the Sex and the City women, you could really see being television stars, but not at their age being movie stars. And, you know, always being supporting in movies, but here they, you know, they're the stars of their show, and they've become quite big in their own.
Well, when that transition happens in the movies, if, for example, someone who's been a character actor becomes a lead or you know, moves back and forth between independent and mainstream, what sorts of things do happen to their persona? Does it depend on the person, or are there sort of regular things in addition to the makeover?
You can look at someone like Jennifer Lopez, I think, and even though she didn't exactly start as a supporting person, she certainly was on television first, and then she moved into film. But even the transition between something like Selena, where she's clearly ethnically marked, that's what the film is about, to something like The Wedding Planner, where she's sort of very whitewashed and very homogenized, and they're really trying to make her into a much more normative kind of female role, and it doesn't work, but it's interesting
no,
that
it
that's,
doesn't.
That's what they're trying to do with her, that they have to sort of, homogenize her and make her this more normative figure. So that's a very interesting role to try to change her into that. That's the one I can think of.
Hank Sutton?
I was thinking about a couple of other examples, also contemporary women who, it seems to me, have a particular struggle here in this transition. I was thinking of Winona Ryder, who starts off in kind of eccentric films. Maybe not a character actor exactly, but she's, you know, in that risky independent category. And then there's a sort of, what happens if you become a big star by being kind of odd? And
like Christina Ricci.
Christina Ricci, yeah, is in a similar kind of position, and the way they get presented becomes very strange, because both of them are defined by a kind of interesting, intellectual, strong, rebellious girl early in their career, and, you know, it's kind of interesting to watch how that's going to play out.
Well, it's interesting, because that's a plot line that plays out in movies a lot, where you have, you know, the intellectual or rebellious or somehow independent younger woman who then ends up eventually by the end. Hank Sarton writes film criticism for the Chicago Free Press and the Chicago Reader. He's also a lecturer in the humanities at the University of Chicago. Here on Odyssey's Film Forum, we're talking today about character actors, and we'll take some phone calls a bit later in the program. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. It's toll-free anywhere in the U.S. We're also talking with Pamela Robertson-Wojcik, who teaches in the Department of Film, Television, and Theater at Notre Dame University and is at work on a book about typecasting. And from Berkeley, California, we're joined by Allison McCracken, who will be teaching this fall in the program in American Studies at Temple University and has written extensively about supporting and character actors across media, film, television, and radio. Allison.
Can I also mention, Gretchen, the internet and the importance of the internet
in terms of
supporting players and character actors? I mean, it's really interesting how important certain character actors and supporting players become to audiences, and I think that's something to really emphasize. And you really see that happening with the internet very much. They can be supporting players in films or character actors in films or television stars or supporting players. A really good example I can think of is Christian Bale, who it may not be, you know, a huge name in the United States, but has been a character actor for years, is just recently in Reign of Fire with Matthew McConaughey sort of off-casting in both of those roles as sort of these macho leads in a film. But it's very interesting because Christian's always had this more... maybe intellectual or thoughtful young man characterization, and he is huge on the internet. He's one of the top 10 stars in terms of websites on the internet, and a lot of that is young girls.
Is that going to become like the equivalent of saying he's huge in France? Like they say about Jerry Lewis,
he's huge on the internet.
But it really points out, I think, how these character actors can really have their own sort of cult status and these huge audiences that really respond to them. And it's a lot easier to tell how that's happening because you can just, you know, get on the internet and look at these sites.
Can we talk a little bit more about the shift that you identified earlier, Pam, where our expectations about what a lead could be, particularly what a lead could look like, changed at a certain point? We got maybe a little more variety?
Right, because I think that this intersects with, in the last part of this conversation, I think there's a blurring between supporting actor and character actor. Mm-hmm. And historically, they might have been the same thing, and now I don't think they are. I mean, it's hard for me to think of someone like Winona Ryder as a character actor.
Why?
It's tricky. I think of her as a starlet, an ingenue who might grow into or might have grown into leading roles. A character actor to me is someone who will remain at that smaller level. But I think that what you've had since the 50s is a return in a way to a Stanislavski idea of what a character actor is.
Mm-hmm.
An actor who seeks out more complicated roles, who tries to avoid being typecast, even though that's probably impossible. And actors will define themselves as character actors despite their star status. So that Dustin Hoffman will say, you know, I'm a character mm-hmm. actor. And, you know, in the old days, there would be a pay scale difference, there would be a billing difference, there'd be all these things. And it changed in a kind of post-50s Hollywood, I think for a variety of reasons. I think the demise of the studio system in part, but I think more importantly, just changing tastes, more of a youth market, a different perception of what was allowable as beauty, so that stars like Barbara Streisand, who in another era probably would have been the quirky friend, could be considered a glamorous star. Someone like Dustin Hoffman, someone like Gene Hackman. When Gene Hackman first hit the scene and was being nominated for a starring Academy Award, people said, how can you do that? He's a character actor.
he wasn't perceived as a star because he didn't look like one. And now, you know, that distinction, I think, is much harder for us to place, although I think we still have a sense that Joan Cusack is a character actor or supporting player, whereas Julia Roberts is a star.
Well, I was just going to ask, have we moved back to a more rigidly conservative or normative idea of what a star can be than maybe existed at some earlier time?
I don't know. I mean, I think that what you have now are all these different levels of stars, and, you know, there are sort of top-notch stars who make huge money, and they're more conventional. Then you have this sort of secondary level of these stars who move back and forth between independent film and more mainstream film, who,
like,
you know, someone like a Winona Ryder, perhaps, you know, who aren't strictly,
she says grudgingly,
a character shoplifter.
Maybe.
But then I think, you know, I think there are these sort of star character actors like Steve Buscemi or Parker mm-hmm. Posey or Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose names are known, who might not typically carry a film, but we know them and they have a certain prominence, but they seem more like character actors in the old-fashioned sense.
The kind of people that other actors call actors.
Yeah.
He's an actor's actor.
Which means they'll never make a couple million dollars for a movie, but they'll have a nice steady career. You can plug them into a number of different things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, that kind of idea of prestige that gets carried. So somebody like, just to throw in another name, Joan Allen, somebody who has made a career of performances that keep getting, you know, critics, us darn pesky critics, we keep mentioning, oh, you know, I saw this film and Joan Allen was astonishing, you know. And but Joan Allen isn't making, you know, $5 or $6 million a movie. Joan Allen is what people say, she works for the work, you know.
It's also the tie to theater, you know, that I think kind of character actor is perceived as, is, you know, you were talking earlier, Gretchen, about a sort of prestige role, and those tend to be actors who can move between theater and film.
And she was part of Steppenwolf as well, if we can look at John Malkovich mm-hmm. and Gary Sinise and that whole group of people who have that kind of cachet of being part of that theater group.
Let's talk about one more thing before we take a break, and that is sometimes very clearly star types or leading men types will, I don't know what to call it, go slumming in a character role. You know, put in a short performance in some other film. Tom Cruise in Magnolia, for example, which is, you know, in a role that's really different from what we normally think of as a Tom Cruise vehicle. What's going on there, Hank?
Well, I think partly the stars are trying to avoid getting trapped in the box, right? They don't just want to be the pretty face that sells a movie because they're so presentable on the cover of magazines. So you get, you know, Jude Law getting uglified for Road to Perdition. And they wrote, I mean, the paradox, of course, is they wrote extensively about how they uglified Jude Law for Road to Perdition. So we all spent all this time reading and nodding along and saying, oh, yeah, boy, they uglied him up. But there is this weird kind of borrowed prestige to it, too. And obviously, I'm not impugning their personal motives, seminal motives. Somebody may just say, wow, I read that script and I was knocked out. But there is a kind of quality that we think of these as showing that they can really act.
I was going to say, it seems to mm-hmm. further underline the distinction between what they do in their other movies.
And,
Tom Cruise in Minority Report versus Tom Cruise. I just love to bash Tom Cruise. I got to stop.
Why? Why do you have to stop?
It. It's for Nicole.
He's making $20 million a picture. If anyone can take it, it's him.
That's right.
It seems to reinforce, like it may be saying about Tom Cruise, oh, you know, I'm actually a quite deep and complex actor, and yet it just serves to underline the idea that there's Tom Cruise, the movie star, that there is this separate thing.
Right. I mean, there might be another way in which, you know, doing a small role in a film might help that film get made. I mean, there could be sort of some good intentions. And you know, it's interesting, I think, the movement between supporting roles and star roles. A lot of people who do big starring roles only ever get their Oscar when they do the support, because that's viewed as acting. Mm. You know, so I think Gene Hackman actually has only ever won as a supporting actor, and other actors in a similar way, so that the legitimation works.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take some phone calls. Maybe we'll bash Tom Cruise a little more. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Field Museum, presenting Chicago Pageant, A New Canvas 2002, a sound and light show projected onto the museum's north facade, exploring the history, architecture, and people of Chicago. Shows take place Wednesdays through Sundays in August at 9 and 9:35 p.m. Tickets are not required. More information at 312-665-7714. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Northwest Community Healthcare, recognized by Solutions as one of the top 100 cardiac and orthopedic hospitals in the U.S. With over 700 physicians and thousands of patients treated each year, at Northwest Community, experience matters. Information at 847-618-3463. Serving Northeast Illinois, Northwest Indiana, Southeast Wisconsin, and Southwest Michigan with news and culture, this is Chicago Public Radio. WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM and on the web at WBEZ.org. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. It's Film Forum on the program, and we're talking about character actors today. Joining us for the conversation here in Chicago, film critic Hank Sarton, along with film scholar Pamela Robertson Wojcik, and from Berkeley, California, we're joined by Allison McCracken, who is also a film scholar. Our number again, 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Christopher. Hello, Christopher. You're on Odyssey.
Yeah, hello. My question was about actors who start out with fabulous careers as character actors and then get touted as stars, as leading men, for example. Like I might think of Leonardo DiCaprio and work in Gilbert Grape was so wonderful, and I often look at him and think, I don't really buy him as a leading man, but his character work is fabulous. Maybe Keanu Reeves and Johnny Depp also, or some possible
to make the transition.
Well, yeah, they try to make the transition, or the people who advise them say, hey, you can be a big star and become a leading man, and then the work tends, I sometimes think, to suffer. Possibly, and I think that is true in the case of Leonardo DiCaprio, Keanu Reeves.
Okay, let me ask this question. Maybe this is impossible to answer, but is there any reason to think that acting in a lead role is somehow easier than acting in a supporting role?
I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot
pole. Wow! Silence. Hank Sarton, I'm going to make you do it. You're the critic.
Oh, sure. Why not? Well, no, I don't want to say that acting in a lead role is easier. What I would say is that we are used to identifying certain kinds of roles as acting. And the problem, I think, is may not be the star's problem. It may be the audience's problem that we love watching Leonardo DiCaprio do something risky in Who's Eating Gilbert Grape? What's Eating Gilbert Grape? But we... Wow. Okay.
Moving on quickly.
But we once we get that expectation, then we're frustrated to see him do anything else. We want that, you know, risky performance.
We have the feeling that they're not performing. They're just
being themselves.
Right. If they are performing up a storm.
Right, you know, maybe in The Beach that was the most difficult piece of acting he ever did. I don't know. That would be his call, but... We have these expectations that character actors, people we come to identify as doing this challenging, quirky work, they're going to keep being challenging and quirky. And so it's very hard for us as audiences sometimes, I think, to make that transition.
Mm-hmm. Allison McCracken, what do you think about that?
It's interesting because the idea that if you're playing a normative role, you're not trying as hard because normative roles should be easy because they're normative. You know, I'm playing this traditional kind of person. It's easier for me to play this kind of role because it doesn't require me to try harder to put myself into some kind of alternative or, strange position, where it might be actually easier for certain actors to put themselves in that kind of role than to play what would be considered a traditional star's role. But because it's associated, I think, with these kinds of normative qualities that we were talking about, you sort of being, you know, middle class and nice and more narrow boundaries in terms of behavior, you know, just more moderate as opposed to any kind of extreme. I think that certainly it's seen as less challenging in that respect, even though it may be even more challenging for some actors to do that kind of role than another kind of role.
It is part of the demand on a star is to kind of make it look effortless, to make it look like I just am the guy who gets the girl, or, you know, this is just me to some extent.
It's even harder for the star to be the star that to hold the star persona than it is to even act in the movies, to hold that star persona off screen as well, which character actors are not necessarily, they don't necessarily have to do that as much. And again, because they're not stars as much, their names are not maybe as known and they don't get as much publicity. They don't have to sort of hold that persona. I think that's part of the acting the star is that you actually have to do that off screen as well.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Mike. Hello, Mike, you're on Odyssey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is, how has the end of the studio era in Hollywood affected the quality or quantity or familiarity of character actors? For instance, as opposed to, say, instantly recognizable great supporting actors of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Ward Bond, Walter Brennan, Barry Fitzgerald, the Ford, John Ford stock players. How is it, are character actors of then, were they less ambitious, or was it the studio system that prevented them from going on to becoming big stars?
Right. Pam, maybe you can address that.
I think that in the studio era, there were an awful lot of actors who were perfectly happy to play character roles, understanding that they would never be big stars. They could have a terrific career. They were always working. They had steady work. I mean, the idea of acting, you know, in the silent era wasn't perceived as some big deal thing initially. It was kind of a shameful thing to act in films as opposed to theater. Initially, they didn't even bill actors. All the actors got paid the same thing. They rotated in roles. And I think that there was still a kind of workaday ethic in Hollywood for a long time. I mean, this is also an era where a director does the film that he's assigned in whatever genre he's assigned. You don't have as many instances of the director who writes the film. You know, the idea of sort of film as art is in existence, but it's not dominant. People view this as entertainment. And so, you know, if someone can be the sidekick in a million westerns, that's not a bad career. I think that in the post-studio era, you know, you do have this real shift in terms of what it means to be a character actor, and I think that there's more of an assumption that everybody who gets into a movie might have a chance to make it to the top. And I think that, you know, we've been talking about some of that shift between what's a character actor versus a supporting actor, a supporting role versus a supporting actor, because a star could dip in and out of supporting roles and starring roles. You might perceive yourself as a character actor despite the fact that you're a star with star billing, but because you take complex and interesting roles, you're a character actor. So I think that the whole meaning of the term has changed dramatically, and you don't have that same kind of stable of players to call upon, although you do have directors today who still operate more or less in that way. I mean, P.T. Anderson still makes his films with an ensemble cast, many of whom are never going to be big stars, but are sort of happy to be kind of character actors in independent films.
And Steven Soderbergh as well. And yeah, P.T. Anderson, and I think Steve Soderbergh with Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman and people that he uses over and over.
Hank, I was going to say, one day we're going to read somebody's autobiography called Sidekick in a Million Westerns.
It exists. Harry Carey has
My Life,
you know, in the John Ford stable or something.
Okay, let's take another call. Let's talk with Chris. Hi, Chris, you're on Odyssey.
Hi, hello. I love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, I heard an interview with Chris Rock, and he was talking about, I think he was in one of the Die Hard movies, and he, I guess, in filming, he was sort of a minor character that he started to kind of take the show, and they tested it in front of audiences and then wrote his character and more. And my question is, how much, I guess, the path of sort of a character actor to becoming a big star, how much of it is, like, determined on audience reaction and, like, sort of, you know, what the studio sees as, like, where they can go?
Hank?
Well, I mean, I'm gonna speculate here, but it seems to me that there's a sort of strange thing that happens, which is the way deals get made in terms of who's moving up the ladder is largely based on Hollywood perceiving what they think is going on out in the public. Now, the way that they figure that out is partly somewhat scientific and partly just, you know, what's happening in Hollywood at the lunch tables. So there's a kind of weird mix of who did audiences respond to, who did critics respond to, who did the director just love working with, you know, who did we love when we saw something in the screening room when we were looking at dailies. So there's a kind of weird chemistry going on here about how people move around and up and down in their fortunes.
Is all that just shorthand for who do we think will make us some money?
Well, for the studios, absolutely, yeah.
Allison McCracken?
Well, definitely. It's interesting, though, you see somebody like Rupert Everett in My Best Friend's Wedding, where actually, based on test audience reactions to him, he was placed a lot more prominently in that film. And I think the ending was changed as well to the ending where he dances with Julia Roberts based on focus groups. So it can have make quite a bit of difference what particularly audiences respond to. Although the fact that he wasn't nominated for that part, even though he was considered sort of the best supporting actor of the year, really gives a sense that there are other politics at work there in that particular thing. But yeah, I mean, it can make a quite a bit of difference.
All right, let's take one more call before the end of the hour. Let's talk with Will. Hello, Will. You're on Odyssey.
Thank you. I wonder if there is a clear distinction between character actor and supporting actor. The term seems
right.
to be synonymous
They're
in the conversation.
They're very slippery. Hank, can you give us something to work with here?
Sure. It seems to me supporting actor, usually we're just linking to the idea of a supporting role. That is, anybody can be a supporting actor just because they take a small part. But a character actor, that's a kind of career definition. And the funny thing that's been, I think, that we're revealing in this conversation is how much now it's hard to say somebody is a character actor for life, because there's the idea of this system of filmmaking that would make that possible. It's not as much in place. Now somebody drifts back and forth between theater or television and film. And so are they a character actor if they do a bunch of TV and do quirky roles in movies?
I think there might still be character actors. And I think that if you think about...
In the old sense of someone who just does...
Yeah, I mean, roles. I think if you think about people who move between TV and film, someone like Wayne Knight, who plays Newman on Seinfeld, can show up in a number of things. He's never going to cross the line, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I don't even know her name, but the woman who played Janice on Friends, you know, with the weird voice.
Or Maggie Wheeler.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's people...
She's huge on the internet.
...who I think, you know, I do think there is still a category like that of people who still show up and we go, oh, yeah, I recognize that guy, wasn't he in such and such, who aren't ever going to cross the line. I think what's slippery is that there's also this other category of the... more Stanislavski and defined character actor of, you know, complex, interesting, changing roles of a Joan Allen or something. I think there's a sub-world of real character actors still.
Pam Wojcik teaches in the Department of Film, Television, and Theater at Notre Dame University in South Bend, Indiana. She is at work on a book about typecasting. Allison McCracken, let me ask you a final question, and that is, do you see, as these sort of categories change and shift around, does it affect the way films get written?
Well, I think the way films get written is so much about, particularly Hollywood films and mainstream Hollywood films, so much about the economics of it, particularly now in terms of, you know, international globalization and being able to sell a film worldwide, not just within the United States. So I think that there are certain iconic parts or archetypes that they think can be sold really easily internationally, and that's so... and this is a switch to progression from the 70s. I mean, if we think of the 70s as being very much about character actors being stars and being much more local and dealing with specific social issues, perhaps a lot more, now it's really thinking, you know, how can we sell this to the broadest international audience? And a lot of it is not about characters so much as setting up archetypes that people can immediately relate to. And sell. Think about something like Independence Day, where you have, you know, a really specific type that you can sell to a very broad audience. So I think that does affect the writing a lot in terms of, you know, how can we, what are these particular roles that we know can be easily translated and easily sold around the world?
Allison McCracken has written extensively about supporting and character actors in film, television, and radio. This fall, she will be teaching in the program in American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. She joined us today from Berkeley, California. Hank Sartin, I want to ask you the question about writing as well. Do you think that movies get written differently because a person might have a different idea about what sorts of types are out there?
Well, I think at least there's a kind of, for some screenwriters, there's certainly the kind of recognition that there are types that are a shorthand. So, you know, you're looking for a kind of warm, fatherly type, a kind of Paul Sorvino type, right? And you sort of imagine these character types as a way of translating, well, what kind of character am I trying to write? The father is going to be kind of, you know, warm but also kind of gruff. Okay, you know, I know sort of how that works because I've seen the character actors.
Hank Sartin writes film criticism for the Chicago Free Press and the Chicago Reader. He's also a lecturer in the humanities at the University of Chicago. Hank Sartin, Pam Wojcik, and Allison McCracken, thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gretchen.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Allison Rinnick, and thanks heartily to Ernst Carroll for engineering our show today and for the last 2 weeks. Thank you very much, Ernst, for all your hard work. The staff of our show includes technical producer Steve Warnauskas. Our show is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Monday on the program, is imitation flattery or a lack of originality or something more ambiguous? On Monday, we're going to look at imitation and originality in art. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us on Monday for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostruschko. Funding for the program is provided by generous grants from Doris Sasser, the Staines family, and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Chicago Public Radio, this station, or its sponsors. To listen again, visit our website, chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey.